They turn to each other, laughing, and begin to pull them over each other's heads.
It's like the shirt of Nessus,
George Boleyn says, as Norris wrenches him free. George tosses his head to settle his hair back into place. His white skin has flared from contact with the rough wool. George and Henry Norris are the hand devils who seize the cardinal by his forepaws. The two-foot devils are still wrestling each other from their trappings. There are a boy called Francis Weston and William Brereton, who, like Norris, is old enough to know better. They are so absorbed in themselves, cursing, laughing, calling for clean linen, that they do not notice who is watching them, and anyway, they do not care. They splash themselves and each other. They towel away their sweat. They rip the shirts from the page's hands. They drop them over their heads. Still wearing their cloven hooves, they swagger out to take their bow. In the centre of the space they have vacated, the cardinal lies inert, shielded from the hall by the screens. Perhaps he is sleeping. He walks up to the scarlet mound. He stops. He looks down. He waits. The actor opens one eye.
"This must be hell," he says. "This must be hell if the Italian is here."
The dead man pulls off his mask. It is Sexton the Fool, Master Patch. Master Patch, who screamed so hard a year ago, when they wanted to part him from his master. Patch holds out a hand to be helped to his feet, but he does not take it. The man scrambles up by himself, cursing. He begins to pull off his scarlet, dragging and tearing at the cloth. He, Cromwell, stands with his arms folded, his writing hand tucked into a hidden fist. The fool casts away his padding. Fat pillars of wool. His body is scrawny, wasted. His chest furred with wiry hairs. He speaks.
"Why you come to my country, Italian? Why you no stay in your own country, huh?"
Sexton is a fool, but he's not soft in the head. He knows well he's not an Italian.
"You should have stayed over there," Patch says, in his own London voice. "Have your own walled town by now. Have a cathedral. Have your own marzipan cardinal to eat after dinner. Have it all for a year or two, eh? Till a bigger brute comes along and knocks you off the trough."
He picks up the costume Patch has cast off. Its red is the fiery, cheap, quick-fading scarlet of Brazil wood dye, and it smells of alien sweat.
"How can you act this part?"
"I act what part I'm paid to act. And you?"
He laughs, his shrill bark which passes as mad.
"No wonder your humour's so bitter these days. Nobody's paying you, eh? Monsieur Cromwell, the retired mercenary."
"Not so retired. I can fix you."
"With that dagger you keep where once was your waist?"
Patch springs away. He capers. He, Cromwell, leans against the wall. He watches him. He can hear a child sobbing, somewhere out of sight. Perhaps it is the little boy who's been hit in the eye, now slapped again for dropping the bowl, or perhaps just for crying. Childhood was like that. You are punished, then punished again for protesting. So one learns not to complain. It is a hard lesson, but one never lost. Patch is trying out various postures, obscene gestures, as if preparing for some future performance. He says,
"I know what ditch you were spawned in, Tom, and it was a ditch not far from mine."
He turns to the hall where, unseen and beyond the dividing screen, the king, presumably, continues his pleasant day. Patch plants his legs apart. He sticks out his tongue.
"The fool has said in his heart, there is no Pope."
He turns his head. He grins.
"Come back in 10 years, Master Cromwell, and tell me who's the fool then."
"You're wasting your jokes on me, Patch, wearing out your stock in trade."
"Fools can say anything."
"Not where my writ runs."
"And where's that?" "Not even in the backyard where you were christened in a puddle. Come and meet me here 10 years today, if you're still alive."
"You would have a fright if I was dead."
"Because I'll stand still and let you knock me down."
"I could crack your skull against the wall now. They'd not miss you."
"True," Master Sexton says. "They would roll me out in the morning and lay me on a dunghill.
What's one fool? England's full of them.
He is surprised there is any daylight left. He had thought it was deepest night. In these courts, Wolsey lingers. He built them. Turn any corner, and you will think you will see my lord with a scroll of draftsman's plans in his hands. His glee at his 60 Turkey carpets, his hope to lodge and entertain the finest mirror-makers of Venice.
Now, Thomas, you will add to your letter some Venetian endearments, some covert phrases that will suggest in the local dialect, and the most delicate way possible, that I pay top rates.
And he will add that the people of England are welcoming to foreigners, and that the climate of England is benign, that golden birds sing on golden branches, and a golden king sits on a hill of coins, singing a song of his own composition. When he gets home to Austin Friars, he walks into a space that feels strange and empty. It has taken hours to get back from Hampton Court, and it is late. He looks at the place on the wall where the cardinal's arms blaze out, the scarlet hat, at his request, recently retouched.
"You can paint them out now," he says.
"And what shall we paint Elsa?"
"Leave a blank."
"We could have a pretty allegory."
"I'm sure." He turns and walks away. "Leave a space."
Chapter 3. The dead complain of their burial. Christmastide, 1530. The knocking at the gate comes after midnight. His watchman rouses the household, and when he goes downstairs wearing a savage expression, and in all other respects fully dressed, he finds Joanne in her nightgown, her hair down, asking, "What is this about?" Richard, Rafe, the men of the household steer her aside. Standing in the hall at Austin Friars is William Brereton of the Privy Chamber with an armed escort. "They have come to arrest me," he thinks. He walks up to Brereton.
"Good Christmas, William. Are you up early or down late?"
Alice and Joe appear. He thinks of that night when Liz died, when his daughters stood forlorn and bewildered in their night shifts, waiting for him to come home. Joe begins to cry. Mercy appears and sweeps the girls away. Gregory comes down, dressed to go out.
"Here if you want me," he says diffidently.
"The king is at Greenwich," Brereton says. "He wants you now."
He has ordinary ways of showing his impatience, slapping his glove against his palm and tapping his foot.
"Go back to bed," he tells his household. "The king wouldn't order me to Greenwich to arrest me. It doesn't happen that way, though he hardly knows how it happens."
He turns to Brereton.
"What does he want me for?"
Brereton's eyes are roaming around to see how these people live.
"I really can't enlighten you."
He looks at Richard and sees how badly he wants to give this lordling a smack in the mouth. "That would have been me once," he thinks. "But now I am as sweet as a May morning." They go out, Richard, Rafe, himself, his son, into the dark and raw cold. A party of linkmen are waiting with lights. A barge is waiting at the nearest landing stairs. It is so far to the palace of Placentia, the Thames so black, that they could be rowing along the river Styx. The boys sit opposite him, huddled, not talking, looking like one composite relative. Though Rafe, of course, is not his relative. "I'm getting like Dr. Cranmer," he thinks. "The Tamworths of Lincolnshire are among my connections, the Cliftons of Clifton, the Molyneux family, of whom you will have heard, or have you?" He looks up at the stars, but they seem dim and far away, which he thinks they probably are. So, what should he do? Should he try for some conversation with Brereton? The family's lands are in Staffordshire, Cheshire, on the Welsh borders. Sir Randall has died this year, and his son has come into a fat inheritance, £1,000 a year at least in crown grants, another 300 or so from local monasteries. He's adding up in his head. It is none too soon to inherit. The man must be his own age, or nearly that. His father, Walter, would have got on with the Breretons. a quarrelsome crew, great disturbers of the peace. He recalls a proceeding against them in Star Chamber, would be 15 years back. He doesn't seem likely to furnish a topic, nor does Brereton seem to want one. Every journey ends, terminates, at some pier, some mist-shrouded wharf where torches are waiting. They are to go at once to the king, deep into the palace, to his private rooms. Harry Norris is waiting for them. Who else? "How is he now?" Brereton says. Norris rolls his eyes.
"Well, Master Cromwell," he says, "we do meet under the strangest circumstances. Are these your sons?"
He smiles, glancing around at their faces.
"No, clearly not, unless they have divers mothers."
He names them Master Ralph Sadler, Master Richard Cromwell, Master Gregory Cromwell. He sees a flicker of dismay on his son's face and clarifies, "This is my nephew, this my son."
"You only to go in," Norris says. "Come now, he's waiting."
Over his shoulder, he says,
"The king is afraid he may take cold. Will you look out the russet nightgown, the one with the sables?"
Brereton grunts some reply. Poor work, shaking out the furs, when he could be up in Chester, waking the populace, beating a drum around the city walls. It is a spacious chamber, with a high, carved bed. His eye flickers over it. In the candlelight, the bed hangings are ink-black. The bed is empty. Henry sits on a velvet stool. He seems to be alone, but there is a dry scent in the room, a cinnamon warmth that makes him think that the cardinal must be in the shadows, holding the pithed orange, packed with spices, that he always carried when he was among oppressive people. The dead, for sure, would want to ward off the scent of the living. But what he can see across the room is not the cardinal's shadowy bulk, but a pale, drifting oval that is the face of Thomas Cranmer. The king turns his head towards him as he enters.
"Cromwell! My dead brother came to me in a dream."
He does not answer. What is a sensible answer to this? He watches the king. He feels no temptation to laugh. The king says,
"During the 12 days between Christmas Day and Epiphany, God permits the dead to walk. This is well known."
He says gently, "How did he look, your brother?"
"He looked as I remember him. But he was pale, very thin. There was a white fire around him, a light. But you know, Arthur would have been in his 45th year now. Is that your age, Master Cromwell?"
"About."
"I am good at telling people's ages. I wonder who Arthur would have looked like if he had lived. My father, probably. Now I'm like my grandfather."
He thinks the king will say, "Who are you like?" But no. He has established that he has no ancestors.
"He died at Ludlow. In winter, the roads impenetrable. They had to take his coffin in an ox cart, a Prince of England, to go in a cart. I cannot think that was well done."
Now Brereton comes in, with the russet velvet sable-lined. Henry stands up and sheds one layer of velvet, gains another, plusher and denser. The sable lining creeps down over his hands, as if he were a monster king growing his own fur.
"They buried him at Worcester," he says. "But it troubles me. I never saw him dead."
Dr. Cranmer says from the shadows,
"The dead do not come back to complain of their burial. It is the living who are exercised about these matters."
The king hugs his robe about him.
"I never saw his face till now in my dream, and his body shining white."
"But it is not his body," Cranmer says. "It is an image formed in your Majesty's mind. Such images are quasi-corpora, like bodies. Read Augustine."
The king does not look as if he wants to send out for her book.
"In my dream, he stood and looked at me. He looked sad, so sad.
He seemed to say I stood in his place. He seemed to say, you have taken my kingdom, and you have used my wife. He has come back to make me ashamed.
Cranmer says, faintly impatient,
if your majesty's brother died before he could reign, that was God's will. As for your supposed marriage, we all know and believe that it was clean, contrary to scripture. We know the man in Rome has no power to dispense from the law of God. That there was a sin, we acknowledge. But with God, there is mercy enough.
Not for me, Henry says. When I come to judgment, my brother will plead against me. He has come back to make me ashamed, and I must bear it.
The thought enrages him.
I alone.
Cranmer is about to speak. He catches his eye, imperceptibly shakes his head.
Did your brother Arthur speak to you in your dream?
No.
Did he make any sign?
No.
Then why believe he means your majesty anything but good? It seems to me you've read into his face what was not really there, which is a mistake we make with the dead. Listen to me.
He puts his hand upon the royal person, on his sleeve of russet velvet, on his arm, and he grasps it hard enough to make himself felt.
You know the lawyer's saying, le mort saisit le vif, the dead grip the living. The prince dies, but his power passes at the moment of his death. There is no lapse, no interregnum. If your brother visited you, it is not to make you ashamed, but to remind you that you are vested with the power of both the living and the dead. This is a sign to you to examine your kingship and exert it. Henry looks up at him. He is thinking. He's stroking his sable cuff, and his expression is lost.
Is this possible?
Again Cranmer begins to speak. Again he cuts him off.
You know what is written on the tomb of Arthur?
Rex quondam rex qui futurus. The former king is the future king.
Your father made it sure. A prince coming out of Wales, he made good the word given to his ancestors. Out of his lifetime's exile, he came back and claimed his ancient right. But it is not enough to claim a country. It must be held. It must be held and made secure in every generation. If your brother seems to say that you have taken his place, then he means you to become the king that he would have been. He himself cannot fulfill the prophecy, but he wills it to you. For him, the promise, and for you, the performance of it.
The king's eyes move to Dr. Cranmer, who says stiffly,
I cannot see anything against it. I still counsel against heeding dreams.
Oh, but, he says, the dreams of kings are not like the dreams of other men.
You may be right.
But why now? Henry says, reasonably enough. Why does he come back now? I've been king for 20 years.
He bites back the temptation to say, because you are 40, and he is telling you to grow up. How many times have you enacted the stories of Arthur? How many masks, how many pageants, how many companies of players with paper shields and wooden swords?
Because this is the vital time, he says. Because now is the time to become the ruler you should be, and to be sole and supreme head of your kingdom. Ask Lady Anne. She will tell you. She will say the same.
She does, the king admits. She says we should no longer bow to Rome.
And should your father appear to you in a dream, take it just as you take this one, that he has come to strengthen your hand. No father wishes to see his son less powerful than himself.
Henry slowly smiles. From the dream, from the night of shrouded terrors, from maggots and worms, he seems to uncurl and stretch himself. He stands up. His face shines. The fire stripes his robe with light, and in its deep folds flicker ochre and fawn, colours of earth, of clay.
Very well, he says. I see. I understand it all now. I knew who to send for. I always know.
He turns and speaks into the darkness.
Harry Norris? What time is it? Is it 4 o'clock? Have my chaplain rope for mass.
Perhaps I could say mass for you,
Dr. Cranmer suggests. But Henry says, no, you are tired. I've kept you from your beds, gentlemen. It is as easy as that, as peremptory. They find themselves turned out. They pass the guards. They walk in silence back to their people, the man Brereton shadowing them. At last, Dr. Cranmer says,
neat work.
He turns. Now he wants to laugh, but he dare not laugh.
A deft touch, and should your father appear to you? I take it you don't like to be roused too often in the small hours.
My household was alarmed. The doctor looked sorry then, as if he might have been frivolous.
Of course, he murmurs. Because I am not a married man, I do not think of these things.
I'm not a married man either.
No, I forgot.
You object to what I said?
It was perfect in every way, as if you had thought of it in advance.
How could I?
Indeed, you are a man of vigorous invention. Still, for the gospel, you know...
For the gospel, I count it a good night's work.
But I wonder,
Cranmer says, almost to himself,
I wonder what you think the gospel is. Do you think it is a book of blank sheets on which Thomas Cromwell imprints his desires?
He stops. He puts a hand on his arm and says, Dr. Cranmer, look at me. Believe me, I am sincere. I cannot help it if God has given me a sinner's aspect. He must mean something by it.
I dare say, Cranmer smiles, he has arranged your face on purpose to disconcert our enemies. And that hand of yours, to take a grip on circumstance. When you took the king's arm in your grasp, I winced myself. And Henry, he felt it.
He nods.
You are a person of great force of will.
Clerics can do this. Speak about your character. Give verdicts. This one seems favourable. There the doctor, like a fortune-teller, has told him no more than he already knew.
Come,
Cranmer says.
Your boys will be fretting to see you safe.
Rafe, Gregory, Richard, cluster around him. What's happened?
The king had a dream.
A dream? Rafe is shocked. He got us out of bed for a dream.
Believe me, Brereton says, he gets one out of bed for less than that.
Dr. Cranmer and I agree that a king's dreams are not as other men's dreams.
Gregory asks, was it a bad dream?
Initially, he thought it was. It isn't now. They look at him, not understanding, but Gregory understands.
When I was small, I dreamed of demons. I thought they were under my bed, but you said it can't be so. You don't get demons our side of the river. The guards won't let them over London Bridge.
So are you terrified, Richard says, if you cross the river to Southwark?
Gregory says,
Southwark? What is Southwark?
Do you know, Rafe says, in a schoolmaster's tone, there are times when I see a spark of something in Gregory. Not a blaze, to be sure, just the spark.
That you should mock with a beard like that.
Is that a beard? Richard says. Those scant red bristles? I thought there was some negligence by the barber.
They are hugging each other, wild with relief. Gregory says,
we thought the king had committed him to some dungeon.
Cranmer nods, tolerant, amused.
Your children love you.
Richard says,
we cannot do without the man in charge.
It will be many hours till dawn. It is like the lightless morning on which the cardinal died. There is a smell of snow in the air.
I suspect he will want us again,
Cranmer says,
when he has thought about what you have said to him, and, shall we say, followed where his thoughts lead him.
Still, I shall go back to the city and show my face. Change my clothes, he thinks, and wait for the next thing. To Brereton, he says, you know where to find me, William. A nod, and he walks away. Dr. Cranmer,
tell the lady we did a good night's work for her. He throws his arm around his son's shoulder, whispers, Gregory, those Merlin stories you read, we're going to write some more. Gregory says,
Oh, I didn't finish them. The sun came out.
Later that day, he walks back into a panelled chamber at Greenwich. It is the last day of 1530. He eases off his gloves, kidskin scented with amber. The fingers of his right hand touch the turquoise ring, settling it in place. The council is waiting, the king says. He is laughing, as if at some personal triumph. Go and join them. They will give you your oath. Dr. Cranmer is with the king, very pale, very silent. The doctor nods, to acknowledge him, and then, surprisingly, a smile floods his face, lighting up the whole afternoon. An air of improvisation hangs over the next hour. The king does not want to wait, and it is a matter of which councillors can be found at short notice. The dukes are in their own countries, holding their Christmas courts. Old Warham is with us, Archbishop of Canterbury. It is 15 years since Wolsey kicked him out of his post as Lord Chancellor, or, as the Cardinal always put it, relieved him of worldly office, so allowing him the opportunity in his last years to embrace a life of prayer.
Well, Cromwell, he says, you were Councillor. What the world comes to?
His face is seamed. His eyes are dead fish eyes. His hands shake a little as he proffers the Holy Book. Thomas Boleyn is with us, Earl of Wiltshire, Lord Privy Seal. The Lord Chancellor is here. He thinks in irritation, why can Moore never get a proper shave? Can't he make time, shorten his whipping schedule? As Moore moves into the light, he sees that he is more dishevelled than usual, his face gaunt, plum-coloured stains under his eyes. What's happened to you?
You didn't hear. My father died.
That good old man, he says. We will miss his wise counsel in the law. And his tedious stories, I don't think.
He died in my arms.
Moore begins to cry. Or rather, he seems to diminish, and his whole body to leak tears. He says he was the light of my life, my father. We are not those great men. We are a shadow of what they were. Ask your people at Austin Friars to pray for him.
It's strange, Thomas, but since he went I feel my age, as if I were just a boy till a few days ago. But God snapped his fingers, and I see my best years are behind me.
You know, after Elizabeth died, my wife... And then he wants to say, my daughters, my sister, my household decimated, my people never out of black, and now my cardinal lost. But he will not admit, for even a moment, that sorrow has sapped his will. You cannot get another father, but he would hardly want to. As for wives, they are two a penny with Thomas Moore. You do not believe it now, but feeling will come back. For the world, and all you must do in it.
You have had your losses, I know. Well, well.
The Lord Chancellor sniffs, he sighs, shakes his head.
Let us do this necessary thing.
It is Moore who begins to read him the oath. He swears to give faithful counsel, in his speech to be plain, impartial, in his manner secret, in his allegiance true. He is getting on to wise counsel and discreet, when the door flies open and Gardiner swoops in, like a crow that spied a dead sheep.
I don't think you can do this without Master Secretary, he says. And Warham says mildly, by the blessed rood, must we start swearing him all over again?
Thomas Boleyn is stroking his beard. His eye has fallen on the Cardinal's ring, and his expression has moved from the shock to the merely sardonic.
If we do not know the procedure, he says, I feel sure Thomas Cromwell has a note of it. Give him a year or two, and we may all find ourselves superfluous.
I am sure I shall not live to see it, Warham says. Lord Chancellor, shall we get on? Oh, you poor man, weeping again. I am very sorry for you, but death comes to us all.
Dear God, he thinks.